And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The two-minute warning has sounded and the Washington Deciders are in this to win. It's been a rough game from the start, which has turned even some of their fans against them. But winning is everything to this team, so they're pulling out their best trick plays. Okay, the quarterback has the ball. He's handed it off to Kempthorne, who's trying an end run. Wait, what's that? Oh my gosh, what rules are they playing by? That doesn't look fair. We'll be right back to take a closer look at this questionable play when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's true. With time running out, the Bush administration is rewriting the rule book. In their attempt to hopefully hand the ball off to a new Republican leader in November, they are recrafting the rules of the game. Advantage, their team. Today, we go in-depth as we look at the new game plan, which simply rewrites the will of the American people by executive fiat. Personally, I think it's yet another un-American, undemocratic expression of something between a total numbness to reality or a willful stealing of the goodwill of the American people. The removal of environmental protection now from whole realms of our public policies and lands needs to be understood for what it is, a dangerous attack on the very fabric of our living systems. We begin today's show with a discussion with Rob Maraca, who is an articulate spokesman and defender of the protections offered to endangered species, which are being erased right now. And in segment two, we talk with Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, Kieron Suckling, who provides a passionate and well-informed perspective on the significance this policy of transforming the spirit and letter of the law for protection of our endangered species without congressional view, and what it portends for the well-being of our great living legacy of America's lands and waters. So let's get started. August 2008, there's 2 months until the election, and 4 months until there's a new administration, and that may have a factor in terms of what we're going to be talking about today, which has to do with some radical changes, once again, coming out of the administration as it regards to oversight, particularly in terms of endangered species. To help us really understand this particular evolving story, we're now talking with Rob Maraca, who is with the Center for Biological Diversity at biologicaldiversity.org. Rob is joining us from Las Vegas. Rob, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
Well, how are things in Las Vegas?
Well, besides hot, they're very busy.
Ah, in which sense?
We have lots going on in the state regarding environmental issues, and the Center for Biological Diversity is relatively new to the state of Nevada. We just opened our Nevada office in February, so I'm deep in the thick of it, providing input and insight on federal and other projects and their potential impacts on species or habitats and climate change.
Well, there's been an evolving story about changes that are being proposed by Dirk Kempthorne. Can you give us a background on what's happening?
For the past 35 years, we've had a system in place of checks and balances that has worked to serve species and their habitats very well. Basically, it's a process called consultation. So when a federal agency that is going to be doing a project or a private group with federal funding is going to be doing a project, they must consult with Fish and Wildlife Service to check and see if there are any threatened or endangered species or critical habitat present in the project area. It's a very simple task. The action agency, for instance, the Forest Service or BLM or Federal Highways, would request from the Fish and Wildlife Service a list of species that occur within their project area or critical habitat that has been identified within their project area. And that's the beginning of a process called informal consultation. And then if there's no species or critical habitat present, well, then that's the end of consultation. But if there is, then the action agency is tasked with performing performing what's called a biological evaluation. And what a biological evaluation does very briefly is determine, will this proposed action have an effect, or could it have an effect on species or their habitats? And if the answer is no, and the Fish and Wildlife Service agrees, that, again, is the end of informal consultation, a very streamlined, very speedy process. But if an action may have an effect, then together the Fish and Wildlife Service and the action agency enter into discussions on will it be likely to adversely affect the species or the habitat. If they determine that it is not likely to adversely affect, again, the Fish and Wildlife Service would concur, and that would be the end of the informal consultation process. If there is a likely adverse effect from the action being proposed, then the action agency and the Fish and Wildlife Service would go into something called formal consultation. And what the proposed rule does, proposed change to the regulations does, is basically take the informal process out. The peer review and the checks and balances provided by agency biologists checking with counterparts who are probably more knowledgeable in Fish and Wildlife Service about their analysis of the situation is being eliminated and handed solely over to the action agency, which goes against traditional science. In science, we have standards for what science is. It's not value-based. Science is finding facts and proving or disproving those facts. And when you can measure an action, like a new drug, for instance, for the treatment of, say, AIDS, we can do statistical analysis on the effectiveness of that drug. And that statistical analysis is part of the quality control, quality assurance, if you will. But even there, that result, that study result, and I think everybody's familiar, goes before a panel of others to be evaluated, looked at, scrutinized, and then is published in some kind of a peer-reviewed journal. For actions of federal agencies, however, you can't do a statistical analysis. So the only check and balance, if you will, to make sure that it is a objective and bias-free look is subjecting it to peer review, which is what the informal consultation process did. And now that is being removed, and it's kind of analogous to the fox guarding the hen house. The action agencies are tasked with doing actions. Unfortunately, more and more, the political process is interfering with good science and good management on the ground. And biologists and ecologists on the ground in the action agencies are more and more being under pressure from their superiors who are reporting to Washington to come up with certain results that may not be supported by good science. And that is why we need to retain the informal consultation process.
As to why that's happening, that's worthy of about 4 days' worth of discussion, which
yeah,
we can't get into here. But there are some very, very powerful forces at work here that are affecting all of these things. You're absolutely right. Good science requires people knowledgeable and controlled tests, particularly as you're dealing with any kind of animal life or flora, fauna, whatever it is. And we're not just talking about animals. We're also talking about plants and ecosystems and balance. Those are very complex sciences, and people have to have real knowledge to be able to make those determinations. But what, as you say, is being forced to happen now is that all of those decisions, those preliminary decisions, scientifically based decisions, or at least they should be, are now being dumped into the laps of each one of these individual agencies, who then are supposed to somehow come up with this expertise to make those decisions. Is that really possible?
I think in a perfect world it is possible, but unfortunately, for the past probably 30 years or more, we've not lived in a perfect world. Increasingly, the action agencies are given a set of expectations by the administration. In some cases, in the 80s, for instance, the big push was to get timber harvest off of the public lands. More recently, the big push is for oil and gas leasing. So those expectations for production kind of bump up against the agency's ability to be unbiased in determining whether or not that action is going to adversely affect species or critical habitat. And therein lies the rub. The other problem that the agencies are facing, even if you could remove the political interference, the budgets for the action agencies have been on a steady decrease under the Bush administration. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. The Fish and Wildlife Service, which is tasked with administering the Endangered Species Act, for the past several years has seen rapid declines in their budget. For instance, in 2008, they experienced a 7.5% reduction, which amounted to $5.5 million. In the proposed 2009 budget, there's a further 2.5% reduction, or $3.7 million. And the consequence to the agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, is that they have approximately 30% of the positions that deal with the Endangered Species Act administration vacant. They can't fill them. Because you add on the real budget decreases, onto that you have to tack on inflation and in cost of doing business, which is also going up, with drives the purchasing power, if you will, of their budget dollar down. So then let's take a look at the Forest Service. In 2008, the Forest Service in their Fish and Wildlife Program had an 11% reduction, which amounted to $14.1 million. In the proposed 2009 budget, there's a further 10.6% decline, or about $14 million. And they've had to cut 130 positions across the nation in the Forest Service that deal with the Fish and Wildlife Program. Now, getting back to the proposed changes in the regulations, what does this mean? What it means is that the administration's argument that the agencies are adequately staffed to do their own analysis of whether or not a project is going to adversely affect species or their critical habitat is flawed, because they've not supported the agencies via the budget to be able to acquire the staffing necessary. So it's a rather dismal situation, and it really is a huge threat to the 1,300 and some species that are listed on the endangered species list and those species that are in the queue waiting to be listed. This administration has been very, very, very slow on acting on petitions to list new species. We were just successful in having the polar bear added after many years of tries. So it is a rather bleak situation right now.
One of the upsides of this, one could hope, would be that there would be all sorts of new openings announced in every agency in the country for field biologists and expertise, but I don't think that's probably in the future.
Now, wouldn't that be nice? But given the budget trends that I've told you about, that is not in the cards right now.
Another level of challenge here is, whereas before the power rested in law, that's being changed now such that, and this is what's allowing this to happen, and that is by executive fiat, in other words, an agency director, has now the right to make these internal changes without there being changes by the law, so that very many of these types of things are happening under the radar screen.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate situation as well. I think we're all familiar with a former congressman, Richard Pombo from California, who has over the years tried to make drastic changes to the Endangered Species Act legislatively, and fortunately he failed. Unfortunately, what the administration has done under these proposed changes to the regulations is incorporate that which they failed to get legislatively and put it into effect through an administrative process, which, as you pointed out, is largely blind to the public. They publish a notice in the Federal Register, and unless you're up to speed and check the Federal Register or on some kind of an action alert network, you probably won't even know what's happened. The other disconcerting thing is that the standard for public review for something of this magnitude is 60 to 90 days. In this situation, the administration has chosen to give the public only 30 days to review a highly complex, very technical proposed change to the regulations. 30 days is wholly inadequate for even those familiar with the topic to provide good and reasoned comments, more or less the general public and citizen activists who might be interested.
How is input by the public being dealt with in perhaps these new regulations? In other words, Do they have any legal bearing? If there is enough outcry about a particular endangered species that may be affected by some action in an agency, is there still an opportunity for people to have legal action to stop that or to slow it down or to have it reviewed at another level?
Fortunately, to a point, for that, we have another keystone environmental law, the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, as people call it, which requires a federal agency to do an environmental analysis and to fully disclose the impacts and consequences of projects on the environment and both human and natural. What these proposed changes to the ESA regulations do is by exempting a number of activities, including those, for instance, that deal with global warming and greenhouse gases, from the consultation process and from evaluation under the Endangered Species Act for their consequences to species and their habitats. By doing that, they're taking away a good chunk of information that would have been brought into the NEPA process and more fully disclosed to the public. So again, it's kind of a backdoor way. They're limiting the scope of what is going to be looked at as far as Endangered Species Act, which then provides the agencies more of an opportunity to hide those in NEPA because there's no paper trail about the potential impacts. It hasn't been looked at. They're going to be able to say it's inconsequential. There was no consultation required. So it sort of corrupts the whole process. But in theory, NEPA would be another opportunity for the consequences of these proposed changes to be vetted before the public, and then through the NEPA's public involvement process, the public would have an opportunity to weigh in.
This particular point of power, that is to say the effect on endangered species from issues that relate to global warming, and were possibly one of the last-ditch efforts to control or at least affect certain types of actions. So without that, there is almost no way to legally challenge certain actions. Polar bear have been utilized to challenge certain actions, putting in coal power plants, for example. And in the past, it would be required that to have that okayed, people would have to do an environmental impact statement to say, how might this affect the polar bear?
Yes.
That's kind of off the table now.
Yeah, it is. And unfortunately, because the agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service specifically, in New Mexico, required as part of the consultation process for a new coal-powered fire plant, the action agency to consult regarding global warming and the impacts on endangered listed species such as the polar bear. What this new proposal to the regulations would do would be to reverse that agency policy and, in effect, put any kind of discussion about the impacts of greenhouse gases and global warming off the table when it comes to effects on listed species and their critical habitats.
Mm-hmm. Rob, at one point in your career, you were a supervisor of Utah's Fish Lake National Forest. That's a very monumental task. There are so many different angles and aspects to that. I'm just curious, based on your experience, how you see this really affecting, for example, national forests. On the ground, how is this going to affect this country and environmental legacy?
Well, I'd be very, very afraid. As a forest supervisor, you have responsibilities under the law to ensure that the legal requirements and the biological requirements for the conservation of endangered species and plants are being met. And with the staffing cutbacks, reducing the number of field botanists and biologists and ecologists on the ground for an agency like the Forest Service, it becomes more and more difficult to, from a science perspective, adequately evaluate and determine the effects of an action on listed species. If you don't have the people there with the expertise, you're not going to be able to do a very good job. You're basically going to be winging it. One of the things that having a partner like the Fish and Wildlife Service involved in the consultation process was you could tap into their wealth of knowledge. And even though your field biologist, for instance, might be new and may not have a full grasp of the ecology of a species and its habitat, they would be able to bounce their ideas off of a Fish and Wildlife Service biologist, and together we can make the determination, is this action going to adversely affect the species, and if so, how can we modify it so it doesn't? Or maybe it doesn't have an effect, and we can all be happy and go about our business. But that's being taken away, so I think it's going to put well-meaning managers and biologists on the ground in a very difficult situation to redeem their responsibilities under the Endangered Species Act.
Well, with some of the mantras that we're hearing these days of drill, 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 and there's a lot of pressure, and perhaps, although I'm not exactly sure that it's true, the public is beginning to embrace that concept, although I kind of really wonder if it is. That means that there is a political effort to really expand out dramatic changes on our public lands. It's been happening for years, but now it's becoming a mantra. Do you see that type of movement impacting some of the historic protections on the public lands?
Well, I do, and as you said, it's sort of like a steamroller running over the species, particularly those in the Intermountain West and Southwest. Just an example, the Bureau of Land Management, which manages a great deal of surface resources in the West, as well as all of the underground resources, 37% of their budget in this current fiscal year for Fish and Wildlife's program went to supporting the oil and gas development program. So what they're doing is putting their biologist, instead of working on recovery plan and actions for instance, the sage grouse in Wyoming or Colorado, Utah, and Nevada, the biologists are working on writing reports in support of oil and gas leasing. And this is where the political influence comes to bear on well-meaning biologists. They are basically being told by the administration, we want to streamline the permitting process. To do that, we need you to sign off that this action will not adversely affect species. They're given very short deadlines. They're basically given the answer before they start writing, and it's co-opting and corrupting the entire process.
I would have to believe there's some very frustrated scientists. I'm a scientist myself, and, you know, we hold to the truth. I can't say something is real until I really have a sense that it is. The politicization of the process must be extremely difficult to people who otherwise come to their task with an effort to just discern the truth.
It really is, and I experienced that firsthand. I started out my career in the Forest Service as a silviculturist, one that deals with tending the forest for objectives and resources. And I moved into then forest ecology, a little broader perspective, and worked my way up through the organization and spent a lot of time in Washington working on ecosystem management in the early 90s. And only to be frustrated then when the Bush administration came in, and I was a forest supervisor, as you mentioned, on the Fish Lake Forest, with the new expectations, the new marching orders, the new demands to get products off the forest, seemingly in disregard of good science. It led to me to leave the agency early. I took an early retirement because I could not ethically stay in the Forest Service under the Bush administration's marching orders.
Well, it is very personal to you, and I appreciate your sharing that. That's significant. At this point, what could people do? The unfortunate thing is the fact that there has been such a concentration of, as you say, it's like a steamroller that's just moving forward. I don't exactly know how we're supposed to turn that around in any sort of reasonable amount of time, but perhaps you have a different perspective, or maybe not.
Well, I think it's not hopeless. Maybe the light at the end of the tunnel might be the 4 months that you mentioned remaining before a new administration. And to be quite frank, I don't know where Barack Obama or John McCain stand on this particular issue. And in fact, I doubt that they're even aware of it, given some of the higher level, broader issues that they're dealing with in their campaigns. But one of the things that I think the citizen activists and conservationists can depend on is that the national environmental groups, such as the Center for Biological Diversity, will be taking this on legally and challenging the administration on this point. There's also the opportunity for the public to weigh in individually by submitting comments within the short 30-day window, expressing their displeasure with what is being proposed by the administration. But maybe more importantly, and I think all conservation actions really are most fundamentally important where the action hits the ground. And I would just say that activists and conservationists need to remain active in the local planning efforts that are going on in their areas and providing sound input and calling for the use of sound science in informing decisions. So I think being involved in the NEPA process is perhaps the way most people can still make a difference and affect the outcomes.
There's still time before this election happens. People do have an opportunity to meet with these candidates in public forum. If a person were to formulate a question to ask them, how might they do that? Because unfortunately, these questions are never asked by the talking heads. Maybe one lucky person may be able to ask that question somewhere between now and the election to at least draw the answer out.
I think if you pose it on a broad policy, how will you ensure that science is not co-opted by the political process so decision makers have access to independently reviewed, sound, defensible science in making your decisions? We all know that decisions ultimately have to blend science, societal values, and other values other than the species. But what the species need is for a sound position. Here is the impact if you do this, without it being softening or being weakened by the political process before it even gets to that point.
Very good. Put your thinking caps on, everybody, and ask that question. I know that in the 2004 election, environmental were raised one time. Unfortunately, in this particular go-around, the environment now has been morphed into energy independence, and somehow nature and this balance of the living systems is completely off the table. We're shooting ourselves in the middle of the forehead here if we don't really understand that it's all interconnected, and it still is, and it always will be. Rob Maraca, who's with the Center for Biological Diversity, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's been my pleasure. Keep up the good work.
With this solid footing, we next head down to Tucson and talk with Kieron Suckling, Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, to broaden our understanding of the implications these rewrites can have on our living systems. Stay tuned.
Was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As the November elections approach, there may be two fundamental visions of our future. One would suggest that our beliefs and values should shape our decisions above all else. Another acknowledges that a diversity of values and opinions define the American experience, and we must base our decisions on science and truth to assure the continuance of the opportunity to express our varying values. This just may be at the core of the Kemp Thorne strategy. We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Well, now we continue our show about changes that are being made at the executive levels of our government, passing these changes down into the various agencies, specifically the changes that Dirk Kempthorne has mandated. related to review of projects around the country that could have an impact on endangered species. And to continue this discussion, I now want to welcome to the show Kieran Suckling, who is the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Kieran, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I received a press release about this particular change by Dirk Kempthorne with the Department of Interior. Could you give us a brief summary of your concern of the changes?
Yeah, he made two changes. They're both draconian and I think would reverse the 35 years of progress we've seen on endangered species. The first is to remove the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as an independent auditor of other federal agencies and allow those agencies to make their own determination about whether their projects are going to hurt endangered species. So, for example, if the Bureau of Reclamation is going to build a dam, currently it would need to get the outside approval of the Fish and Wildlife Service before doing that. And since the Fish and Wildlife Service has no financial stake in the building of that dam, it's in a place to give an objective opinion. But if you ask the Bureau of Reclamation, which is building the dam, to then judge whether the dam hurts endangered species, it has a massive and obvious conflict of interest, and so it's always going to come back with the decision that no, this is fine. In fact, over the years, we've seen that the Fish and Wildlife Service very often disagrees with these agencies on the environmental impacts, and that disagreement proves its objectivity and its need to be present in this process. So basically, Dirk Kempthorne is really proposing now to put the fox in charge of the proverbial hen house and turn over endangered species decisions to agencies who have a financial incentive to harm those species.
I was trying to think of a good analogy, and I thought of the idea that it's sort of like talking to a drug addict and saying, look, we're going to let you make a decision about whether or not you think you need some more drugs.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Or another one, if you look at what just happened with our whole mortgage meltdown. What happened there was the mortgage companies had a financial incentive to give out bad mortgages.
Sure.
When they should have been objectively reviewing these and saying, no, this is not a good deal. So, I mean, it's a form of deregulation is what it is. And in fact, what's very interesting about this is that the Bush administration did a test run of this concept the last few years with logging in western states. The results were absolutely dismal. The U.S. Forest Service violated the Endangered Species Act the majority of times when allowed to do its own review. And so then the Bush administration suppressed the report showing this and instead proposed to expand it nationwide. So they already know that this proposal will fail for species, but they don't care because their measure of success is that it produces more timber, more mines, more natural resources. As far as they're concerned, it's a success that the species got harmed.
It's all about winning.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not an even playing field any longer. The rules have changed.
No, not at all. And then let me talk about the other change to put in. So when the federal agencies are supposed to make this determination of whether or not their actions are going to drive species extinct, they have to do so under a certain scientific standard. The administration has, as a matter of policy, now said, oh yeah, and by the way, greenhouse gas emissions, no matter how damaging they are to endangered species, are off the table. So you're actually banned from even attempting to review the impact of global warming on endangered species, which is absolutely crazy given the fact that global warming is shaping up to be the single biggest threat to endangered species. And now we're banning the agencies from actually even reviewing that problem. It's extraordinary.
We're hopefully at the end of this run. One can certainly hope that there will be a change somewhere by either candidate. I'm not even going left or right. I'm just saying.
I think that's right. Regardless of whether it's McCain or Obama, there's going to be a change for the better. I mean, McCain and Obama are very different in their positions, but I think both are considerably better than George Bush, that's for sure.
I certainly hope that somewhere in this campaign, someone actually asks both candidates whether or not they support this change, because I think it needs to be on the table.
And this did happen, actually. The Associated Press asked Obama what he thought of it, and he basically said, this is a disaster. It shouldn't happen. If it does happen, I'll try to reverse it when I get in. The McCain camp had no comment, and I don't know if that's because they just didn't know what the deal was because it had happened so quickly, or whether they were seriously considering it. It's difficult to tell.
To me, it's a defining aspect of the difference in the campaigns, that in terms of just a vision about where America should be going and how that can happen. Thank you for that information. I may call up the McCain campaign and ask that question.
Initially happened right after the policy came out. So if we're fair to McCain and say, well, he just didn't know what it was. Well,
fair enough, yeah.
It's been a week now. So he should have figured it out by now, and let's see what his position is.
We don't have to go real political here, but, you know, there are realities as well. And unfortunately, one of the mantras that is swirling around the McCain campaign is drill, drill, drill. And that has direct impact on the things we're talking about here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the driving force behind these changes is the Bush administration's correct perception that the Endangered Species Act is finally starting to get a little toehold in on oil and gas drilling, and they can see down the road and go, yeah, okay, a decade from now, it's going to be a major, major issue. There's going to be no oil and gas drilling that doesn't go through very substantial endangered species review. So they're trying to put the finger in the dike right there and cut that off. So I think that it very much does tie back into positions on oil and gas drilling.
One of the things that concerns me, and I've been doing the show here for about, it's going on 5 years, and the changes that I feel conscious of, I'm not comfortable with, because I think that we're just headed down a slope here. And one of the things that concerns me very much is the fact that even within the environmental community, environmental issues have been completely co-opted, and in to a certain extent, rightfully so, by the issue of energy independence. But therefore, the concept of biological diversity or the importance of the natural world is completely off the table.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was disappointed, to say the least, but I think more than that, even just really sort of taken aback by how quickly the debate turned from what should a global warming bill look like under Lieberman Warner to how quickly can we drill for oil.
Absolutely.
And it was, I mean, it was like 1 week, we're debating this very large bill, which would have huge structural changes to our economy. It goes down, and then gas prices go up, and all of a sudden we're talking about the exact opposite proposal. And the Dems, frankly, did a very poor job of taking the high ground and saying that these high gas prices should spur us away from oil. Instead, they got sucked into it, and just a couple days ago, Pelosi actually came out and said, now we'll entertain a bill to expand oil drilling offshore. We're actually going to reverse the policy put in place by the first Bush administration.
I don't see, I'm getting a little depressed, in the sense that we're, in some respects, we're losing the battle, and the battle has to do with biological diversity. Well, I'm totally in accord with what you guys are all about, the Center for Biological Diversity. That's critical to our survival. It's what all of life depends on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is the very foundation of life on this earth. In fact, I'll tell you how foundational it is. The very oil that we're putting into our car is the decomposed bodies of plants and animals. Plants and animals make everything human.
And coal and natural gas.
All of it.
Yeah.
All of it, you know. And it's a huge concern to me because I track every single endangered species in the United States very closely, and quite a few in Canada and Mexico. And one of the things we attempt to do is really gauge the year-to-year changes in the population size of the species and whether they're recovering or not, and why. And one of the things we've seen is that once a species is put on the endangered species list, its decline toward extinction usually stops, and the majority of them start increasing in population size. Some fairly rapidly, in California area, for example, you got the California least tern, huge population increase. Some much more slowly, like the condor, tremendous amount of work. It's kind of a day-by-day thing, but it's the right direction. But all of that progress over the last 35 years has come from these strong policies requiring that the Fish and Wildlife Service serve as an objective outside judge on impacts to the species. And so by taking that away, we're taking away the policy that we've seen help species, and I very much fear that all these gains are going to be reversed very quickly, and for some of these species, there's just no room for reversal. I mean, if you've got a fish that's down to 200 or 300 fish left, 18 months of bad policy can drive it extinct. It just does not have the buffer room to make a mistake of this caliber and come back and fix it 3, 4, 5 years later. It's not enough time.
I think one of the questions that people might have is, why is diversity so important? Let's go a little bit esoteric here. I think it's until we're able to really recreate that awareness, and I do think there was a period of time when people did have that sense, but it's just so far off the table. How can we get people to realize just how important diversity is and how these differences in the regulations are going to affect the capacity for this diversity to maintain?
I think one of the key things, one of the things that's interesting to me and I think most biologically important is that what we're fighting over here is not simply this or that plant or animal, but the whole concept of diversity and biological diversity. Because our ecosystems, our natural world, works best and is able to produce clean air and clean water when it has a diversity of species on the ground. They give the whole system great stability. So as we start to lose populations or entire species, there's less diversity out there, which means that the systems become much more unstable and are likely to degrade. I'll give you a metaphor here, which I think is actually not entirely a metaphor. I actually think it's part of the same broader ecological concept. But in a political system, if you have multiple parties, diverse opinions, that system tends to be stable because no one position is going to dominate and take over, and consequently, the political systems tend to be moderate and democratic. If you've got a political system where one party runs the table, there is no diversity, it tends to veer off toward tyrannical states, towards very unstable systems. And so just as in politics you want diversity to sort of level the playing field and provide checks and balances, it's the exact same thing in the environment. If you have 100 species out there, well, a disease that comes through may only affect 10 of them, and so you've got 90 left, and so you've got some stability. If you reduce the diversity out there so there's only 10 species, and all 10 get hit by the same disease, you have a ecological collapse. So it's very important that we keep this broad diversity of species, especially somewhere like San Diego. San Diego County has the highest biological diversity in the lower 48 states. It's extraordinary. You just drive around from the coastal sage scrub up into the chaparral, up into the mountains, and you're constantly passing by species that exist nowhere else on Earth.
Amazing 60-mile drive.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And so, but it also means that what's at stake is much higher there. What can be lost is much greater. And I think that San Diego County and 5 or 6 other places in the entire country should be at the top of our list for state and federal funding and management plans to preserve that diversity, because it's once it's gone, can't bring it back. And that's what's unique about this issue. If you have polluted air or polluted water, you can say, okay, we made that mistake. We're going to clean it up now, and 5, 6 years later, your water's cleaner. But if a species goes extinct, you cannot reverse that mistake. Mm-hmm. It's an all or nothing proposition. And so we need to work very, very hard to ensure that that never happens.
Tyrone, one of the things I'd love to talk with you about is where you see the trends. I mean, for example, one of the stories that I keep hearing about is what's happening to the amphibians. Now, I know that when I was a kid growing up in the Midwest in Minnesota, Wisconsin, gosh, you go out to any kind of pond or something, and it was an amazing reality out there. I believe that that's changed. You have the information. Let's talk about amphibians first, because I do hear a lot of stories about that. But then any other classes or whatever that you feel are really being impacted, and perhaps why?
Yeah, the amphibians are one of the most endangered group of species. Actually, not the very most. I'll talk about another group later. But they're in tremendous trouble all over the world. And the reason for that is that amphibians occur in water and on land. So they are subject to threats on both places. Their skin is very permeable, and it tends to be wet because it's in the water, and that means that it's much more susceptible to air pollution and water pollution. When they reproduce, the way they do it exposes the sperm to the water. And so right at the very beginning of life, even just prior to life, if there is any water pollution, it's going to instantly impact the sperm of the species. And so for all these reasons, the amphibians are right on the forefront of whatever impact we have on the environment. And not surprisingly, they are in decline all over the world, all over the U.S. It's air pollution, it's water pollution, it's exotic species. A lot of chemical impacts are a real problem. One of the things that happens is all of the various medicines that we humans use, and very importantly, also birth control medication, gets flushed down our toilets out into the wetlands, and then these species are subjected to this chemical soup. And we're seeing deformed amphibians all over the country due to this chemical impact. People call it endocrine disruptors. Basically, we're disrupting the species' endocrine system, and they're becoming deformed. And obviously, these deformed individuals can't live. So it's a tremendous problem.
So with the amphibians, water flows downhill. These animals live where everything ends up.
That's right.
And they, unfortunately, they can't escape it. They're not, you know, the amphibians are the new canary. They are telling us stories. They're warning us about...
Yeah, they can't get up
fly
away.
That's exactly correct.
They're right there. Another group of species, which is an even greater trouble, is our freshwater mussels. The United States is the epicenter of mussel diversity in the world. There are more freshwater mussel species in the U.S. than anywhere on Earth. They're primarily located in the southeastern states, Tennessee, Virginia, Kentucky, going into Alabama. The vast majority of all of them are imperiled. Many have already gone extinct. In fact, the biggest extinction spasm in the United States occurred in the Tombigbee River in Alabama and Tennessee. It's horrific. And what's happened there is that by building these dams, we prevented the mussels from being able to move upstream, and we have silted in their habitat. They need to have these rocky cobbles. Instead, that just gets all covered with silt and pollution. And then the water is chemically polluted, and it's a tremendous disaster. I have to say, as bad as things are in the West, I'd say there's a pretty strong general environmental consciousness there. There's a broad understanding that many of the impacts that we're causing should be stopped. In the Southeast, you just don't see that kind of level of interest. I mean, there's virtually no talk in the Southeast, for example, about removing dams that are driving species extinct, mm-hmm. whereas there's a lot of discussion about dam removal from California all the way up to Washington State. Mm-hmm. So we're even farther behind the curve when it comes to river systems in the Southeast, and we're paying the price for that impact. In fact, this is a very interesting example of the price that humans pay in this regard. Freshwater and marine mussels, they feed by just sucking water through their bodies and filtering out the nutrients in the water. So they're all like little filters. And these mussels, when they occur in the numbers that used to occur, which is the billions, they have the capacity to filter every drop of water in Chesapeake Bay through their bodies and clean it in a period of about 9 years. So when those mussels declined, our water, our natural water cleaning filter disappeared, and consequently the water is a lot more polluted now, and that is impacting fisheries of all kinds. We have huge human impact from driving these species extinct.
Coming back to sort of where we started out, this is the reason that good science is critical, because otherwise we're just guessing. We have no idea what's really going on. What's happened to the biological survey? At one point, that was going to put all the biologists to work, going out and recording every living thing.
That's right.
What happened to that?
It got derailed. During the Clinton administration, Secretary of Interior Bruce Babbitt attempted to create a whole new agency, the National Biological Survey, and it had a very visionary agenda of really figuring out where all the species are in the country, what their management needs are, and provide the scientific information we would need.
Such a beautiful concept.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, he proposed that at a time when the Republicans were in charge of both the House and the Senate. They crushed that idea, and we really just lost that whole concept and all the knowledge it would have produced. And I think science is critical to all of this. We just don't know what's happening with these species. We don't know what we as humans need to do to improve their lives unless we have scientific monitoring and research. And I that's why I think it's no accident at all that at every single turn on the environment, what you see the Bush administration doing is censoring or even preventing science from ever being done. I mean, science is the enemy of the Bush administration on the environmental issues, because they can't control it. I mean, they want to have everything debate about economic values and tax incentives and all this kind of stuff where ultimately it's all opinion. I mean, there's no fundamental right or wrong there.
You're right.
They want everything to be in that realm of opinion. And so they just hate science. It informs debate and provides a basic bright line of what is true and what is not true. And the Bush administration views that as a terrible limitation on its power, and on they're right. It is a limitation on their power. It's a proper limitation, and so consequently, Bush's war on the environment is very much a war on science. It's the same thing.
One of the aspects of the administration is a sense of supposedly a personal responsibility, that a person should have a sense of paying the consequences for their actions, except when it comes to these kinds of issues.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there is no way to monitor effectively the consequences of one's actions. I mean, for example, in our own health, we have a thermometer. You put the thermometer in your mouth and you know if you're healthy or if you're tending towards unhealth, you know?
Yeah, no, that's right. The Bush administration would say, you know, if you're sick, go watch Fox TV and see what their see what their opinion is on your condition. You know, there's no monitor, there's no doctor, and it's a disaster. In fact, we're battling them right now on a project in Texas where they are allowing massive destruction of endangered species habitat on public land. One of the big legacies of the Bush administration is that it took a very successful program in which the military for decades was doing great things for endangered species. Turned that on its head and has really turned the military into an anti-endangered species agency. And we're seeing massive reversals of policy on military bases at great harm to endangered species. So in Texas, there's a big base there called Fort Hood. For many years, has done some great habitat management, increased the size of two endangered songbirds there, the golden-cheeked warbler and the black-capped vireo. Now the Bush administration comes in and says, hey, we're all about war. We have nothing to do with the environment. Why are you doing that? Let's reverse that. Let's now start destroying that habitat. As they proceeded, there were huge objections. to this. And so the Bush administration set up this attempt to mitigate the damage, which was to basically pay private landowners to manage their habitat for these species in exchange for allowing the federal habitat to be destroyed. Well, I don't think that's a great idea to begin with, but even worse, going back to our science issue, they banned any public knowledge of where these private lands are, what the management on them will be, and any measure of success with the species. So they basically just said, we're banning all scientific knowledge that would allow us to judge whether this program works. You just have to trust us.
You know, I've never really put this out on the air before, and I don't know that I really believe it, but it's almost as if it's an alien species that's trying to decimate life on Earth.
Well, you know, that's funny you say that. I've heard that said many times in the environmental community. I mean, you do have the feeling that these people in charge of very, very high places have so little regard for life on Earth.
Yes, right.
That you look at them, you wonder, did they really come from here? Is it possible
yeah.
that an Earthling could have so little regard for life on Earth?
Yeah.
It makes you wonder,
yeah.
are they? It becomes the reasonable speculation at a certain point, because how else do you explain this just stunning lack of consideration for our very own planet and the 4 billion years of evolution that got us to where we are today?
It's hard to comprehend. I mean, it really is, just from a human perspective. I think about children these days, and, you know, I mean, the only hope that I can see at this point is so hopefully, perhaps with the new administration, for there to be a massive environmental education and nature education strategy to rekindle a sense of wonder, because it's gone. It's just disappearing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all video games and stuff now. I mean, it's a very different world, certainly than the one that I grew up in. And I do very much worry about the amount of time kids now, especially young kids, spend on computers and TV and not out in the world looking at bugs and plants and things. It's a very big concern. I think that if we don't do a much better job of, it's not even so much education in the sense of, you know, imparting facts to them as just exposing them to the beauty and wonder of nature and let the natural human curiosity drive them.
Yes.
And make them appreciate yeah. what's happening, and there's just not enough of it. You know, I know that the Audubon Society has a big national campaign. I think they want to set up nature centers in every single urban area in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big multi-year campaign of theirs, and I think that's the kind of thing that can really help. I have a friend who runs a zoo in Phoenix, and they actually have kids come in and camp out for weekends inside the zoo.
That's great.
So those are the kind of things we need more of.
Parents to just let their kids go out and look under a rock, to be honest. What? I mean, it starts right there.
Yes, no, absolutely. It starts right there. And even that, shockingly, is becomes more and more difficult. I know where I live. You know, I live out in the desert, and we've got rattlesnakes, and we've got scorpions. We've got all manner of things. But you learn to live with those things. And you teach kids, you know, what's dangerous and what's not. And too often I see parents that are just so afraid of the cactus spiders that they don't let the kids out there at all.
No, that is, unfortunately, everything has become dangerous.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I often get into very big picture speculation now, but I mean, so much of our politics, our economy, our consumerism is built around fear. And be afraid of this, buy this medicine, you know, be afraid of that country, vote for me. It's all fear driven. And so if you're bombarded by fear messages all day long of every kind by someone trying to sell you something, then it becomes very easy to think, oh, nature, dangerous, fearful place.
Everything?
Don't put my kid out there.
Well,
and it's just a shame.
The messaging is terrible. I mean, and we're really wandering here, but it's important. Actually, what we're talking about is the basis of turning this around. We have to start literally on the ground, you know.
Yeah.
Kid comes in, and they're a little roughed up and a little dirty, and it's like, you know, you're dirty-ish, you know. It's not a good thing. Well, wow. we really took off there. But I guess the effort here is to get people to realize that that's where we really where we have to start the change.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, sorry, one thing out there I find fascinating and goes back to the whole question of biological diversity. One of the things a lot of scientists and doctors are worried about on a very day-to-day level is we have these antibacterial soaps that we use everywhere now, and it's a real problem medically because what happens is you're exposing bacteria to these tiny low-level dosages of antibacteria. Mm. It tends actually not really to kill them, but just to push them to evolve faster. And so we're undermining our medicines, but also, this is very intriguing, a bunch of studies now have found that when kids are exposed to the natural bacteria that occur in the yards where they live, it's very helpful to them. It builds up their immune system, and when they're not exposed to that, they have weaker immune systems. So if we're not letting our kids go outside, and then we're spraying these antibacterial soaps and wipes all over the house, kids are just not being exposed to what they need to be exposed to develop healthy immune systems. And what are these bacteria? Well, they're just other species. It goes back to biological diversity. Our interaction with these other species, in this case we can't even see them, are an essential part of our human health.
That is so perceptive in the sense that in the process of trying to eliminate that diversity at that level, yeah, we're affecting our health in a negative way. The diversity is just built into the system, and it's why we're here.
Yeah.
Know?
Oh, absolutely.
Why we're here. Well, amazing. Kieran, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Here's one last question. Getting back way back now to Dirk Kempthorne.
Yeah.
Do you know how soon these changes are supposed to go into an effect?
Well,
and then also, what is the possibility of them being rescinded?
Well, they're supposed to go into effect in approximately 25 days, which is extraordinarily fast turnaround time, which really tells you these guys are trying to shoehorn this thing in before they leave office in a dramatic way. Congress is now trying to intervene and demand a 180-day comment period. My guess is the Bush administration is going to blow them off, put these regs into place. At that point, you're looking at going to court and getting a judge to shut them down. So we're proceeding right now already to design the lawsuit to stop it. And then alternatively, Congress can pass a law overturning it, but that takes a whole lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
A faster effort would be for the next administration to come in and just revoke the policy, which would be its right. So at any rate, all those tacks will be taken at once, and I do believe that one or more of them will work. This policy will get struck down. It's just a question of how much damage will have occurred between now and then.
All the more reason why we need to change the agency directors, which comes from
the
top.
Yeah.
That's really what it, because they now have all the power.
Yeah, the agency directors, and then even at lower levels. I mean, I think one of the key things going to be the new administration coming in is for them to figure out who are the really bad actors. Because sometimes it even occurs at lower levels. In your neck of the woods, frankly, the director of the Carlsbad office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not anyone that should be allowed near any species endangered or not. And so people like that are going to be needed to send packing and replaced with people whose interest actually is science and conservation.
That's what we're doing here, trying to make that change, and hopefully we can. Kieran, why don't you invite people to visit the Center for Biological Diversity?
Yeah, you can go to our website, which is www.endangeredearth.org, and find all kinds of information about particular endangered species, what is being done to either hurt or help them, and find out more about what the center's doing.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for joining us here, Kieran. Kieran Suckling, Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Thanks so much.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Invite your friends to come along as we explore the many voices and wonders of our lands, people, plants, and animals. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.